This is MMA Torch editor Jamie Pennick, and this is the UFC 104 post-show review. I'm joined by Matt Pelkey today to discuss last night's card with the controversial decision giving Lyoto Machida the heavyweight title and letting him retain that title, I should say. But Matt, before we even get to that, we had a ton of action on this card. We got 9 of the 11 fights between Spike TV and the pay-per-view event. So overall, taking the main event and the bad taste from that decision out of the equation, what did you think of this card?
I think it was a pretty good show. It was a little bit better than I was expecting. I wasn't expecting a whole lot from this card. I think having the prelim show on Spike helps out a lot because if we're paying $45 for a show like this, it's nice that we got 9 fights overall. You know, we got 3 on the prelim show and 6 on the, well, I guess we got 7 on the pay-per-view technically, but we got the Stefan Struve, Chase Gormley fight again, which I was curious about at the beginning, but then when I saw the results of the 2 fights we didn't see, there obviously wasn't time to fit those in, but you know, a good job by the UFC just even trying to cram that last fight in for people who maybe didn't catch the prelim show. It was an enjoyable night of fights overall. I thought for the most part the theme of the night was impressive performances. I thought Pat Barry looked fantastic. Chael Sonnen looked fantastic. Cain Velasquez looked fantastic. Anthony Johnson looked exactly like we thought it was going to be. And Joe Stevenson, I thought, really announced that he's going to be working hard to get himself back into title contention. So that just seemed to be the theme of the night for me, aside from the main event, obviously, was guys just having really, really strong performances.
Yeah, for me, before this event, the theme was me not giving nearly enough credit to some very good fighters. You know, I have to eat crow on that one on 3 different occasions. Pat Barry, we'll start with that fight, Anthony Hardonk and Pat Barry. They ended up with the fight of the night, which I'm not sure I agree with. It was a good fight, but I don't know if it was the fight of the night. I thought Chael Sonnen's performance against Yushin Okami almost might have brought that up for him to get him that bonus. But Pat Barry, it came down to his quickness in this fight. I thought it was going to be the reach of Hardonk, and instead it was Barry with some really quick punches and finding his range against Hardonk and finding a way to get in with his shots and took him out in the second round in what was just a, like you said already, a really, really impressive performance. And if Pat Barry can work on his ground game and get some semblance of a ground game, he can be a dangerous fighter for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. He's you know, I think he's, what, 30 years old already, so he's kind of, he's not young in the sport, but he certainly still has 5 or 6 good years, I would think, left in him. But still, he's at the point where, as good of a striker as he is, he just needs to work on takedown defense and submission defense, and he can really become a really strong fighter, just like a guy like Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar's not going to be throwing triangles up anytime soon, but he doesn't need to because he has other tools. Same thing with Pat Barry. He's such a good striker, especially at the heavyweight division, that he really just needs to be good at defending other things to really become a force, and I think that's very possible in the next year or two if he keeps progressing, because his striking is outstanding. It just seemed like at some point, either late in the first round or early in the second round of that fight, just a light bulb went on in his head where he said, well, I can just punch Hardonk in the face anytime I want to. And that's exactly what he did. He was snapping off really fast jabs that were popping back his head, and he just stopped worrying about the leg kicks because he knew he could get through his punches anytime he wanted to. It was a very impressive performance. Very emotional afterwards. He's a very likable guy. there's really not much invested in Pat Barry, so I don't. He's not a young prospect or anything. So throw him to the wolves. Let's see what he's got. The heavyweight division is always looking for new personalities, and after a performance like that on Spike TV, I think Pat Barry's star is certainly on the rise right now.
Another fighter whose star is certainly on the rise, and not only that, but he's extremely young and has a chance to get very good in the heavyweight division, is Stefan Struve in his fight with Chase Gormley, a fight that we ended up seeing twice. This actually went down. This is one of the 2 fights that I actually called correctly. Struve was able to withstand an early takedown from Gormley, and was able to counter out and then get on top of Gormley himself. And once that happened, he showed a very good top game and then set up a beautiful triangle from the mount and picked up the submission victory here in the first round. Struve, at 21 years of age, I think he's 6'11", and he looked like he definitely filled out his frame a bit more coming into this fight. It's the sky's the limit for this kid, because he lost to Junior Dos Santos, which is nothing to be ashamed of at all, in his UFC debut. And he's picked up two straight submission victories. His last one was less impressive because he was getting his ass kicked for a while and was able to sneak that one out over Dennis Stoinek. But this one against Chase Gormley, very impressive performance. And at 21 years of age, he's only got he can only go up from here.
Yeah, definitely. A very impressive performance by him, and I think it was encouraging to see that he got his ass kicked less in this fight than he did in the fight before. He, like you said, he's grown into his frame a little bit more. He's going to get to a point where he certainly has to cut weight to make the 265-pound limit at some point. He's 6'10", 6'11". He's a huge guy, and he's going to put on some weight up to the point where he just walks around at about 280 pounds, and then he could really be a force in the division. He looked better on his feet. He had a nice sweep of a wrestler who was on top of him, got on top, locked up that triangle and rolled over, and that was all she wrote. I think he had an advantage here from having a little bit of UFC experience. Going into your third fight is a hell of a lot different than going into your first fight in the octagon, and he took advantage of that. Gormley looked like he was a little nervous and had to resort to his wrestling, which was probably not what he wanted to do in this fight. But Struve did exactly what he needed to do, lost on the submission and got the win. And, you know, it'll be fun to kind of follow his career as he gets older. Because, like you said, he's really young right now.
Next up was Ryan Bader against Eric Schaefer in another good fight on this Spike TV broadcast. Bader, on two separate occasions in this fight, came very close to knocking Eric Schaefer out, but it's a testament to Schaefer's toughness and his ability to survive that he took this one to the judges. And this one saw Bader in the first round knock Schaefer down with a right hand and then almost blow his gas tank out in that first round trying to finish, as Schaefer somehow survived the onslaught and got back into a defensive position and even tried some submission attempts and kept it from being a complete 10-8 round. And then Schaefer came back to win the second round as Bader was really gassed and Schaefer picked his spots. But then the third round again, Bader seemed to get back a little bit of his energy and again dropped Schaefer with another right hand that nearly put Schaefer out. And then he missed the knockout blow as he came down into Schaefer's guard there. If he would have landed that would have been all she wrote. But Bader goes on to win a decision here. I did not understand the scorecards on this one. I believe it was 30-27, 30-27, and 29-26. So I didn't see that second round going for Bader at all. And then one judge gave the first round 10-8 and gave Schaefer the second round. That one makes more sense than 30-27s to me, but regardless, Bader won this fight.
Yeah, I can understand the 29-26 a little bit, not 30-27s. I thought, not that it was a dominant second round for Eric Schaefer, but I thought he pretty clearly won that. He was landing the more effective strikes. He was the aggressor. Bader had clearly gassed out a little bit. I picked Schaefer to win this fight going in, and I anticipated him needing to weather the storm from Ryan Bader. He's going to have to take some big shots, which he did. I just think Bader hit him so hard in the first round that Schaefer, tough as he is, just could not really get it going the whole rest of the fight. He's a really tough guy. He's really hard to finish. But Bader just hit him too hard. Just almost punched a hole right through him for about a minute or so in that first round while Schaefer was just scrambling, trying to survive. This is a good win for Ryan Bader. He got pushed for three rounds. That's probably the most adversity that he's had to handle, yet he was still basically in control the entire fight. Eric Schaefer might want to take some time away from the UFC and work on his striking so he doesn't have to take beatings like this, because he's very stiff on his feet, and for a guy that's been fighting as long as he has, he should probably be a little more fluid in his stand-up. But you're going to look a little robotic when you get punched that hard. So good win by Ryan Bader, but I think I was even a little more impressed by the toughness of Eric Schaefer in this fight.
Another person that needs to work on his stand-up game is Yoshiyuki Yoshida. This one was fairly easy to see coming. After seeing what Koscheck was able to do to him in December, you just knew Anthony Johnson was going to be able to keep him at bay and land the shots that he needed to land. And Anthony Johnson knocked him out 41 seconds into the first round. This was a stoppage that Mazzagatti got correct. He had one later that he got completely wrong. But Johnson, pretty much, it was a flash knockout, but Yoshida was really hurt by that point, and that right hand just dropped him. Good performance from Johnson, but that missing weight by as much as he did really, really hurt him here. It cost him $60,000 because he would have taken home the knockout of the night were it not for missing weight.
Yeah, I mean, this one kind of went exactly how we thought it would go. It was just too big of a size differential and a difference in the striking game. There's no doubt in my mind that if Yoshida could have gotten a hold of him, he probably could have tossed him to the floor. Probably wouldn't have been able to keep him there, but I think he at least could have gotten the fight to the mat at some point. The problem is he just couldn't get inside Anthony Johnson. Anthony Johnson had no fears and was able to just stand back and tee off on Yoshida. Yoshida certainly needs to work on his striking game, but I think he might want to see if he can cut the extra 15 pounds and get down to lightweight. He just looks like a smaller guy when he's in there against the Anthony Johnsons and Josh Koscheck, who granted are big welterweights, but the welterweight division is full of huge wrestlers who like to punch really hard like that. I mean, I can see a fight with Yoshida going that way against a lot of fighters in the welterweight division. It might be a better idea to try and cut that extra weight, get down to lightweight where he doesn't have so many heavy punchers to deal with. Not much else to say about this fight. Anthony Johnson needs to, if he decides he wants to stay at welterweight for now, he needs to come in at like 170 on the dot next time just to prove to people that he can. Otherwise, just go up to middleweight. He's big enough to deal with the middleweights right now. And I think he would, in the thinnest division in the UFC, he could be right there at the bottom of the top 10 right now, ready to take on some contenders to move his way up. I think he'd be closer to a shot in the middleweight division than he is in the welterweight division. So, I mean, it's up to him what he wants to do, but it just seems to me like middleweight makes more sense for him right now.
Yeah, and I think he'll at least try 170 once more, just to prove that this was about that injury. I mean, and him putting on weight, Willie had that knee injury and wasn't able to keep it off. Again, that's on him. He needs to not let himself get that out of shape, even when he's injured. At the same token, you can understand cutting 50 pounds is a ridiculous thing if you let yourself get up there. So I think he'll take at least one more shot at it. But like you said, he needs to come in on the dot, because if he has any issue with it, he needs to move up to middleweight. We move on to Joe Stevenson and Spencer Fisher in a lightweight bout, and again, we continue our theme of impressive performances with Joe Stevenson. The first round was really close. I gave it to Stevenson for pretty much the last 30 seconds because it was even until Stevenson finally got that takedown and unloaded a bunch of punches to a turtled-up Fisher. But then the second round, it was Stevenson working a superior top game. Got down and trapped Fisher's arm late in the round and unloaded some vicious, vicious elbows until Herb Dean had to stop the fight. That was one of Joe Stevenson's most impressive performances in the octagon, and it showed that he's still shy of 30 right now, and he can definitely get himself back into a title shot if he continues to improve his game like he had the last two fights. Moving to Greg Jackson's camp was the best thing that ever happened to him.
Yeah, absolutely. Greg Jackson knows how to get fighters to believe in his game plans, and that's exactly what Joe Stevenson did here. This is the perfect performance that he needed right here. No point of trying to stand and bang with Spencer Fisher. That was the only way that Joe Stevenson was going to lose this fight. So I was glad we didn't try. He didn't try and repeat his performance against Diego Sanchez, which was just a losing proposition from the beginning as well. You know, that's back-to-back wins in impressive fashion over Nate Diaz and Spencer Fisher. So Joe Stevenson has himself right back where he was, kind of on the outside looking in of the true title contenders, but not too far on the outside looking in. I managed to call this one exactly correct because Spencer Fisher tapped out with his foot, so technically it was a submission. So
you're grasping for straws there.
Yeah, hey, well, that's what it goes down at, so I'm counting it. But yeah, really nice performance by Joe Stevenson. Great top control, and hopefully he sticks with this and realizes this is how he needs to win his fights from here on out.
Next up, we got a prelim fight that a lot of people were not expecting to see on this card when it was announced and not put on either Spike or the pay-per-view broadcast, but Yushin Okami takes on Chael Sonnen in a middleweight fight. And continuing that theme of impressive performances, Chael Sonnen fought the best fight of his career, in my opinion, and absolutely dominated Yushin Okami from start to finish.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great performance by Chael Sonnen. You know, you can kind of keep the conspiracy theories going because the one time Yushin Okami actually gets featured on a UFC pay-per-view is when he gets physically dominated for three rounds to completely bury him, basically. This, I think, solidifies Chael Sonnen as a top 10 middleweight. He took what a lot of people had as, you know, the number two or number three middleweight in the world and just absolutely beat him at his game. He was constantly moving. He outstruck him consistently throughout the fight. Okami was just backing down throughout the whole thing, constantly retreating, and as soon as Chael Sonnen would get his hands wrapped around him, he would dump him down on the ground like he wasn't even there. Really impressive performance by Chael Sonnen. I'm not particularly looking forward to him moving up the ladder and getting some more high-profile fights in the middleweight division, but as long as he keeps fighting like this, he did exactly what people were asking of him. He pressed the pace, fought a pretty exciting style. He wasn't able to finish Yushin Okami, but that would have taken a heck of an effort to do that. I don't think there's a whole lot of people out there that can finish Yushin Okami. But all things considered, yeah, just absolutely fantastic performance by Chael Sonnen here.
Next up, we had Josh Neer and Gleison Tibau. This is just a weird fight because neither fighter was ever close to being finished or close to being dominated or close to being hurt, but Tibau took Neer down at will and couldn't keep him there. Neer had a great defensive game once he got on the ground and was able to get himself back to his feet, and he constantly played the aggressor, but didn't land any solid shots, didn't land anything damaging to Tibau in this one. And the result was he lost a decision because Tibau was able to take him down at will, and he couldn't stop it. I think Tibau had something like 10 takedowns in this fight. It was a ridiculous number. He just continued to shoot in and take Neer down as soon as Neer would close the distance and get him to the cage. It was, you know, Tibau did enough to win, but it wasn't a great fight because neither of them really did much of anything.
Yeah, this one kind of left a bad taste in my mouth along the same lines as the main event a little bit. Like you said, Tibau was able to take him down at will, but usually when you see a situation like that, it'll be a wrestler taking down somebody without any wrestling skills and then not being able to do any damage once it gets to the ground. Well, Tibau couldn't do, not only could he not do any damage, like you said, he couldn't even keep it on the ground. He would take him down and immediately Josh Neer would go to work, and within like 10 seconds or so, he'd be back on his feet. The only problem was Josh Neer was winning the striking exchanges, but not by enough that it would overcome the big slams from Tibau, and they really were. Every time he was taking him down, he was just plowing through him like kind of like Josh Koscheck used to when he was first fighting in the UFC before he decided he was going to be a kickboxer. But yeah, those were really the only effective strikes, for lack of a better term, landed in the fight were the big takedowns by Gleison Tibau. This is kind of why I wasn't looking forward to this fight going in. I kind of saw it as being a stalemate and not a very exciting one, and that's pretty much what we got here. I certainly wouldn't mind not seeing these two fighters featured on a card in the future.
Next up was the co-main event of the evening, Cain Velasquez against Ben Rothwell. There's one thing that was really proved in this fight, just outside of the fact that Cain Velasquez is a very good fighter, very good wrestler, and is very much deserving of the accolades that he's been getting, and definitely deserving of a number one contendership based on what the UFC wants from him. But outside of that, he does not have knockout power in his hands. He cannot finish these fights with his hands against top guys and against guys that can take the damage and withstand the damage. He's going to have his hands full with either Shane Carwin or Brock Lesnar, who have infinitely better wrestling than anyone that he's faced before and have much harder hands than he does. It's going to be an interesting matchup when he gets his title shot, because against either of them, he's going up against someone that is as good or better in the wrestling department and definitely better in the striking department. That's not to say he can't overcome that. He's proved doubters wrong and proved doubters wrong in this fight for sure. Ben Rothwell just wasn't able to even connect on any shots to test his chin in this one. Velasquez fought a perfect fight himself, but he was landing blow after blow after blow after blow, and Rothwell was still taking it and was still surviving because Velasquez just, he doesn't hit hard enough. He doesn't hit hard enough to put his guys away. And then we had a terrible stoppage by Steve Mazzagatti because Rothwell was eating shots against the cage because his hand was on the ground trying to push himself up, and the fight was stopped as soon as he got back to his feet before he could even put his hand into a defensive spot to stop those punches. Now, Velasquez was well on his way to winning this fight, likely could have stopped it in that round, if not, you know, shortly thereafter. But Rothwell was robbed of a chance to survive and attempt something later in the fight.
Yeah, it looked bad. I'm not so sure it was as bad as it seemed. That was a dominant first round by Cain Velasquez. He was just taking down Ben Rothwell at will, unloading shots on him when he was there. Ben Rothwell looked like he was done coming out for the second round. Tried to throw a kick and almost fell over. It just looked like a matter of time. Steven Mazzagatti even came over to him at the start of the second round and said, "I'm not going to let you keep taking shots like that." And Ben Rothwell said, "Okay." So when he got him up against the cage, Cain Velasquez started raining down those left hands. And not only was Ben Rothwell eating those shots, his head was snapping back every time he landed one. So I think just before he started to you know, walk his way back up the cage, Steve Mazzagatti had already decided, "No, I've seen enough." Because as soon as he stood up, Cain Velasquez was just going to drop down for another double leg, scoop him back up, drop him back down on his back, and pound him some more. I think it was just stopping the inevitable. It looked bad, and you never want to take a fighter's chance of winning away, but I almost feel like this was erring on the side of caution here, because Rothwell was taking a lot of punishment in this fight, and it just didn't seem like, with the amount of punishment he was taking, even if he could have gotten to his feet, it's not like he was going to be able to get off a shot that was going to put Cain Velasquez out. So this is just, I think, just saving him from absorbing more unneeded punishment, but certainly the fact that it got stopped right as he was backing up the cage made it look a lot worse.
Yeah, that's true. Before we get over to the main event, what do you think of Cain's chances against either Lesnar or Carwin right now? Seeing what we've seen through seven fights, I believe five of them in the UFC thus far, he's definitely proved himself worthy as a top contender in the UFC, but what do you think his chances are against either of the two competing for the belt next month?
Right now, I would say not good. He looks very impressive taking down guys who aren't very good wrestlers, which he has in his last two fights. Rothwell's okay, but he's certainly not on the level of a Shane Carwin or a Brock Lesnar in terms of wrestling pedigree. So I'm not even sure how successful Velasquez would be taking either of those guys down, much less holding them there long enough to stop them with strikes, because any time that they can get back up is just going to be back in the danger zone for Cain Velasquez, because, like you said, he doesn't seem to have that knockout power right now. So it's going to have to be, especially in a title fight, a five-round grinder of a fight for him to put somebody away and probably have to win a decision. So he needs to, I don't know if that's really a fixable problem. I mean, he trains at AKA, so it's a very good striking camp. Trains with Javier Mendez, who is a legendary kickboxer, so you would think the people he's training with would be able to teach him how to utilize his power as best as possible. And that just doesn't seem to be coming through right now. Maybe a change of scenery or bringing in a new striking coach or something like that to really just focus on how to get more power out of his shots. But other than that, I just don't know. Maybe it's just a matter of he hasn't been training long enough to really commit to his strikes yet. I mean, he's a big guy. He's got to have some power in there somewhere. He's 240 pounds, so it's got to be in there somewhere, but it's just not translating in the cage right now. So I just don't feel like at this point right now he would stand much of a chance against either a Brock Lesnar or a Shane Carwin.
On to our main event, and we had a 5-round battle between Lyoto Machida and Mauricio Shogun Hua. That saw Hua kind of act as the aggressor for the most part in this fight, landed good body kicks and leg kicks throughout the fight to really frustrate Machida, and he really works the body over a lot. But at the same time, Machida was able to counter a lot of body kicks with a straight left hand that definitely stunned Shogun and pushed him back, and that's one of the things that was not commented on at all in the commentary by Mike Goldberg and Joe Rogan. They really dropped the ball in this fight and were very much a pro-Shogun approach to this one. For whatever reason, they were missing whatever Machida was throwing for the most part. At one point when Machida had a big combo and Shogun landed one punch in there, they talked more about Shogun's one punch than they did Machida's combo at the end of that round. But that being said, Shogun won this fight. He won at least 3 rounds in this fight, I thought. The first, for my scorecard, the first round went to him. The 4th and 5th went to him, clearly. I had Machida winning the 2nd and 3rd, but this one is going to be hotly debated for a long time, and that's why they're getting an immediate rematch. Shogun is getting an immediate rematch with Lyoto Machida. That was what Dana White announced at the post-fight press conference last night. And the thing is, it was so close that you can't call this a robbery, but how those 3 judges saw this fight for Machida, seeing all 3 of the first rounds for him, I can't believe none of them gave one of those rounds to, I believe 2 through 4 was given to Machida on one card, which I don't understand how anyone gave Machida the 4th round. But for the other 2 judges to not give Hua one of those first 3 rounds, it was, I honestly don't know what they were watching. But at the same time, Shogun, outside of the leg kicks and the body kicks, didn't do a whole lot other than walk down Machida. And Machida did use a series of knees and elbows and punches and kicks. He was more widespread with his offense and did land some damaging blows of his own. So I can see how some of it could have gone to him. But I didn't think he won 3 rounds in that fight. And I don't think he should have held on to that championship.
Yeah, I'm with you across the board on this one. I scored it the same way you did. I feel the exact same way. I was really angry at Joe Rogan and Mike Goldberg throughout this fight because it seemed like Joe Rogan just wanted to focus on the leg kicks and the body kicks of Shogun when every time he threw one of those, Machida was also landing a hard punch to the head. So which do you really count more, a body kick or a leg kick or a punch to the head? I think the judges, and myself included, tend to favor shots to the head more than shots to the body. If you look at this fight all the way through, Shogun only landed probably 4 or 5 shot punches to the head throughout the entire fight. The rest was just breaking down Machida's body. He fought a beautiful fight, and I agree with you. I had Shogun winning the first round and then the 4th and the 5th, but the first round was close. If you turn off the commentary, I certainly think you could make an argument for Machida winning that round. Like you said, he was more varied in his offensive attack. He just didn't have an answer for Shogun's kicks. His body was bruised and beaten up, and he was certainly slowing down later in the fight. But I just didn't feel like it was a robbery. I'm glad they're doing an immediate rematch. I think, judging by just the interviews and things with Machida leading up to this fight and watching the countdown show, he seemed to be more caught up in trying to project the image of a champion than he was trying to fight like a champion. Because he didn't really fight like a champion here. He didn't seem on his game. This wasn't the Machida that we've seen in the past. This is a fantastic Shogun. Let's make no mistake here. And that's why we think he deserved to win the fight. Brilliant game plan. Executed flawlessly. Ate the shots that Machida threw at him. So it makes sense to do the rematch. Let's find a real winner. Both fighters are going to be a little more aggressive next time out, knowing what their opponent has brought to the fight in the past. So, I mean, let's face it. If Shogun had taken this decision, Anderson Silva would have probably just left the middleweight division behind and moved up to fight Shogun. But as it is now, they'll fight again, and it'll let the light heavyweight division sort itself out for a little while, and then maybe there'll be another true contender waiting for the champion when they come out of here. This is not the way that you want the UFC's light heavyweight championship to finally get defended successfully after changing hands so many times in the last 2 years, but that's the way it goes down in the history books, and I just don't feel like it was as big of a injustice as a lot of people are making it out to be.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to the rematch now because I think it's going to be a much better fight than this one was. I mean, while this one was really, really close, again, it was a case where neither fighter was close to finishing the fight. And, you know, they talk about you do have to beat the champion to win the belt. And Shogun, I thought what it was going to come down to was Shogun's aggressiveness and octagon control because he was the one pushing the pace the entire fight. And that's what I thought really turned it in his favor. And obviously that wasn't seen by the judges watching it at cage side for whatever reason. But it's not a robbery, and it was a close fight. It was a razor-thin fight that either fighter honestly could have taken. I thought it was even going into that fifth round, which was really the only completely clear-cut round for Shogun. So the rematch now, we're going to see both fighters learn from this fight, learn from what they did, learn from what their opponent did. Going into the next one, I think we're going to see a lot more out of both fighters, and I think we're going to see a much different outcome. I think one of them will stop the fight in that next one. I think they'll need to because they won't want to let this happen again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the real point. This is what happens when you leave the fights in the hands of judges. We've seen bad decisions before. We'll see them again. So don't let that happen. Neither guy clearly established himself as the winner, so they were at the mercy of the judges here. I think you're right. I think both guys are really going to bring it the next time out, and I can't wait to see it as well.
Yeah, so we've definitely got a lot of stuff to look forward to when it comes to the light heavyweight division and a rematch between these two. Cain Velasquez going in to a likely title shot next. Joe Stevenson trying to reemerge as a threat in the lightweight division. We've got a lot of storylines coming out of this event that fighters are going to be able to ride for the next few months until their next fights and going forward here. A lot happened here, and this was definitely an important event for a lot of fighters. With some very good performances and impressive performances, and we'll see what they're able to do in the future in their next fights to improve upon what they've done here. I think we've got a lot of fighters to look forward to seeing again. Stefan Struve, I'm very excited to see how this kid can continue to develop. I mean, at 21 years of age, to have as many fights under his belt, first of all, as he does, and to have that 6 submission game when you're 6'11", if he can continue to work on his stand-up and his wrestling ability as well to go along with his jiu-jitsu game, he's going to be a big threat in the heavyweight division in 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. This card just didn't seem like it was going to have a lot of ramifications to me going in, obviously other than the main event. But coming out, certainly, you know, Stefan Struve and Ryan Bader still are still highly touted prospects and have bright futures, but also Pat Barry, you know, can say that he's now a contender in the heavyweight division. Anthony Johnson can say that in the welterweight division. Joe Stevenson can say that he's back to being contender in the lightweight division. Cain Velasquez in the heavyweight division. I mean, there's just a lot. Chael Sonnen in the middleweight division. There's a lot of fighters who really put themselves on the map in this show, and it ended up being a much more newsworthy event than I ever anticipated it would be.
All right, Matt. Well, we've got plenty more to talk about this week about this event and fallout from this, and then we get into the month of November where we've got six events on television and pay-per-view between Strikeforce and UFC and WEC. So plenty to talk about heading into next month and everything going down with that, with Fedor fighting Brett Rogers, Brock Lesnar fighting Shane Carwin, Tito Ortiz, Forrest Griffin II, Randy Couture, Brandon Vera. We've got a ton of stuff coming up next month, so plenty to look forward to. And until next time, for Matt Telke, this is Jamie Penick signing off.